mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's every Saturday, the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we're your favorite hub. Saturday nights, right here on News Radio 570 WWNC plus AM 1400, and they don't call it the talk of the mountains for nothing. Well, as you should know, one of my favorite people in the world of paranormal research is a great writer. He is a personal friend. He and I have done TV shows together. We have done conferences together. He appeared in the Inside the Church of Satan documentary. He's a guy who has written about everything bizarre, whether it is ghosts or cryptids or secret government files. And so when I learned that he was going to delve into the mystery behind the Men in Black, I was excited. And I'm even more honored that there is, I guess, most of a chapter devoted to a conversation that he and I had regarding one possibility behind who the Men in Black actually are. You'll find a link at speakingofstrange.com to his website regarding this new book called The Real Men in Black. He is Mr. Nick Redfern. Welcome to the program, Nick.
Hey, Josh, how's it going?
Very well. Just so happy that you've written this book. And you've been a busy man lately, huh?
Yeah, it like, keeps me out of trouble, I guess, if I write books.
I don't know about that. And, you know, before we dig into the Men in Black, let me just bring up something real quick, because you have done a lot of research regarding mysteries and paranormal phenomena surrounding celebrities. And we found out today that Amy Winehouse died 27 years old. And Forrest and I were talking about before the show how, the, you know, Jim Morrison was 27 when he died. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain. Some people say there is a curse to this age of 27 with musicians. Do you have any feelings or thoughts on that?
Oh, you put me on the spot now.
Yeah, three off.
I'll be honest, I really don't. I mean, I don't say that there isn't anything to it. I think what does sometimes happen, though, is, you know, kind of certain musicians who are actually very good musicians, you know, are kind of drawn to that whole lifestyle of, you know, drugs. And, you know, it's kind of seen that, you know, heroin and everything else is perceived as being kind of cool. You know, you're a rock star up on stage, and there's this tendency to think you're invincible and immortal and different to everybody else. But at the end of the day, you make a corpse just the same as everybody else does, whether you're 27 or 87.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you know, you can look at Amy Winehouse and see that, you know, you can argue it was on the cards, you know. It was just one of these situations, and I think, you know, you can look at that, as you point out, whether it's Kurt Cobain or, you know, Jimi Hendrix or Jim Morrison, they put out great music, but you can almost see it's like a train wreck waiting to happen. You know, they're great musicians, but it's sometimes great musicians, you know, they just flourish and then they're gone. You know what I mean? So.
Sure. Yeah, there must be something about the timing.
Oh, yeah, there's something going on where there's something in, like, the human psyche where certain people are sort of gravitate to this subject or that subject, whether it's music or whatever or writing. And they really put out something that people are probably going to appreciate and remember for centuries, you know, as long as we last. But there's something about them where, for some weird reason, they're not destined to last. You know, they become like a legend, and it almost amplifies the importance of the work they're doing purely because they do die early. So.
Yeah. Well, now, when it comes to the paranormal in general, there are those clear-cut categories I mentioned, you know, ghosts, cryptids, UFOs, psychic phenomena, and yet one thing that tends to blur the lines between all of these subjects is this topic, the Men in Black, because Men in Black, in one form or another, seem to continually pop up in these stories, and there is all this this enduring mystery about whether or not these are regular human beings who are government agents, or if they're members of some shadow government, or they're aliens, or time travelers, or things that are so weird maybe we can't comprehend. What approach did you take in order to begin your formal investigation to produce this amazing book, The Real Men in Black?
Oh, well, thanks for calling, mate. That I appreciate it.
Sure.
As far as my sort of approach on the subject was that, you know, I mean, there have been various books written on the Men in Black over the years, but one of the things I found was that various people who'd written about the subject were sort of pretty much, promoting as fact their own agendas. And my view has always been, you know, the Men in Black mystery is a definitive mystery. And so what I wanted to do was not sort of lecture to people and say, hey, you know, this is what the Men in Black are, or that's what the Men in Black are. I wanted to approach the phenomenon and the subject from a totally fresh approach and say, there's a mystery, but I'm the first to admit, and I'll, you know, put my hands up and admit that, you know, that we're, to a great extent, we're in the dark as to who the MIB are, what they want, what their modus operandi is, etc. And so for that reason, what I really wanted to do was to try and look at the old cases, the new cases, previously unseen cases, address all the various theories, and then present the data for the reader. Because, you know, I think if we're honest with ourselves, with a lot of these phenomena, you know, we don't really have a full understanding of what's going on. And I think we're sort of cheating ourselves and the reader if we pretend we do. But I think by presenting all the data and the theories, we can at least have some sort of understanding that might lead us to a conclusion, if you like. So that was sort of the approach I took with the book.
So did you start out assuming, we'll use Occam's razor, and let's just start with these being agents of some kind and then get weirder and weirder? Or, I mean, what? Tell me about that journey you took as you looked at different possibilities.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, when anybody mentions the Men in Black, I think certainly there's absolutely no doubt that for people outside of ufological and paranormal research, you know, their first thought is the Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones movies, you know, the Men in Black movies, of which there's actually a new one, a third one in the series coming out next year. And, of course, you know, in the movies, they're portrayed as the agents of some sort of deep cover government agency. Now, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind whatsoever that there is a category of the Men in Black that do seem to be working for the government, or they're part of some sort of, you know, covert government organization that is really on top of the classified UFO data. But the more you dig into it, the irony is you find that the real Men in Black, or the far more prevalent Men in Black, don't sound anything like government agents. They're often described as sort of being 5 foot to 5 feet tall, 5 foot five tall, excuse me, sort of very pale, white faced, almost anemic and anorexic looking. They don't seem fully conversant with our ways and mannerisms. You know, they wear this clothing that's way out of fashion and time, the fedora hats, the skinny black ties. You know, they look like they've walked out of a 1950s Frank Sinatra gangster movie or something like that. And on top of that, you know, they sort of appear and disappear in the blink of an eye, sometimes quite literally. You know, so in other words, it seems to me, and that this is one of the things I conclude in the book, is that, you know, when people say, well, who are the Men in Black? I think we have to ask, which Men in Black are you talking about? There seems to be at least a couple of categories of MIB working. You might argue alongside each other, but sometimes possibly even, you know, almost competing with each other. You know, there could be several things going on. You know, it's our tendency as human beings to try and pigeonhole something into this category or that category. I actually think the MIB, you know, they're that weird that they actually almost kind of defy categorization and fall into several realms almost.
Well, one of my favorite references to the Men in Black was in John Keel's classic, The Mothman Prophecies. And unfortunately, when the movie version was made, they didn't have enough time to include the Men in Black. But I do recall from reading the book that when all this weirdness began to occur around Point Pleasant, West Virginia, one of the Men in Black went to a local diner, and I think he ordered Jell-O or something like that, and people witnessed witnessed him trying to suck it through a straw, which no normal person would do. And that is an example of how they don't seem to understand the customs of a human that we take for granted, huh?
Yeah, you're right. Now, if they look totally normal, you could say, well, that person's just a weird person. But, you know, on top of the fact that, you know, you quite rightly point out they try to sort of, you know, eat Jell-O in a very weird way. You know, people have said, you know, I have pointed out that they're small, they're short, they're skinny, they look pale-faced. Some witnesses have said that they, you know, when they've turned up, the MIB have these sort of large wraparound sunglasses on, and when they've sort of peered at their eyes closely, they seem to have oddly spaced eyes, or almost, as one described them, like thyroid eyes bulging beneath these dark sunglasses. So everything about the Men in Black kind of smacks of being alien. Now, when I say alien, I mean literally alien in the sense of not being human. Now, whether that means, you know, whether it means alien or whether it means extraterrestrial, whether it means interdimensional, what it means, paranormal, who knows? But I think, you know, that there are enough reports, and particularly as John Keel pointed out, where whatever these MIB are, you know, they go far beyond, or ironically, not as far as, you know, government agents. There's something far more sinister and menacing about them than anything that, you know, could potentially surface out of the Pentagon, if you like.
We've got a couple minutes before our first break. Now, you are one of these guys whom I've always admired because you have got the balls to go up to a house and knock on the door. You've done this before, and at some military guy's, you know, abode, and say, "Hi, I'm Nick Redfern, and I'm here to see if you will tell me all of your secrets." Have you been sort of targeted by any Men in Black yourself?
Well, you know, I mean, I get that question a lot. I mean, the short answer is that I haven't. You know, I've never had that sort of late night knock on the front door and these sort of weird looking menacing guys in fedora hats and trench coats. You know, that's not happened. But what has happened, and I would say it's happened probably 10 to 15 times in the last 15 years or so, is that, I'm like you. I do a lot of research and writing, but we're both also on the road a lot. So sometimes, you know, people will email me or leave a message on the phone, and they'll say, you know, "Hey, I've got a story to tell you." And I'll say, "Well, you know, I'm out of town for the next 7 or 8 days. Can I give you a call when I get back?" And they say, "Yeah, sure." And I'll say, "You know, well, what's it about?" You know, they'll give me a brief rundown. So 7 or 8 days later, you know, I get home, phone them up, and their entire demeanor and mannerism has changed. You know, they don't want to talk. They're sort of reticent. They're silent. They say, "Well, you know, along the lines of, I wish I'd never told you." And it transpires that in between their first inquiry and me being away and saying, you know, "I'll contact you in 10 days, they've had sort of a weird, menacing phone call from this sort of almost like a zombie, totally emotionless voice saying, "Do not talk about flying saucers," that sort of thing, which sounds, you know, it sounds controversial and weird, but it's enough to silence the people. Now, that kind of suggests that, you know, either me or the witness has been targeted. Now, I've never, as I said, had that personal targeting by visit or anything like that, but you do have to wonder, you know, when somebody phones you up and you're away for 7 days, and in that intervening period, suddenly the person gets a call, you have to wonder if you're being monitored as well as them potentially being monitored.
Absolutely.
And as I said, you know, if it happened once, you could write it off. It certainly doesn't happen every day of the week, but it has happened probably, you know, sort of 10, 15 times in 15 years. And I think that does demonstrate kind of like some sort of, you know, developing scenario or format where we, particularly in specifically important UFO cases, you know, the MIB turn up and, you know, it's not every light in the sky case, but something significant, they seem to have a reason for surfacing and silencing people, even if it's by intimidation rather than, you know, something even worse.
All right, we'll go ahead and take our first break. When we come back, I will ask Nick Redfern a bit more about the possibility of them being aliens. We'll talk about the photography that has been done. I mean, we know Tim Beckley says he has a photo of a man in black. We're going to get into the connection between MIBs and Ouija boards, time travelers, all kinds of good stuff related to this extremely mysterious and complex subject Nick Redfern's website here, at least one of them you can check out, therealmeninblack.blogspot.com. That's linked up at speakingofstrange.com. I'm Joshua P. Warren. We'll be right back to dig into the Men in Black further here on Speaking of Strange. Asheville, North Carolina, land of the sky. I am Joshua P. Warren on the line with my friend Nick Redfern. His new book is called The Real Men in Black, and it is a classic. And by the way, Nick, before we continue, is that the best website, therealmeninblack.blogspot.com?
Yeah, that's the one. I mean, that's actually sort of generated a lot of reports where people, interestingly enough, since publication of the book, have come forward with their own accounts, literally from as late as last year, you know, demonstrating that the subject's very much ongoing. And if people want to contact me at that site or that blog, then, you know, I always respond quickly and I'm happy to chat with people. So
when you look at the idea these may be aliens, it does make sense because if we are in some type of close cooperation with an alien government, then we imagine that they are enforcing their agenda. Aside from, say, the example that John Keel gave, I mentioned, with the Jell-O, what are some other things you have seen, maybe specific accounts that indicate these are beings not very familiar with what the behavior of a normal human would be?
Well, you know, I mean, I think, you know, several classic issues. One of the most important ones is the fact that the MIB seem to literally kind of manifest or appear out of nowhere. You know, they literally do appear on people's front doorsteps, and, you know, when they've been invited in and the person has sort of spilled the beans on the experience, and then they just enigmatically get up and leave. They literally do vanish into the darkness. You know, people have said they raced to the front door afterwards and opened it, and the MIB are just gone. The reports of people trying to trace down the MIB in corridors and hallways in buildings and things like that, and, you know, they'll race around the corner and they've vanished again. They seem to have this uncanny, weird ability to just appear and vanish. Now, on top of that, of course, you know, just the sheer appearance of the MIB, that they kind of look, you know, they look human in some respects, but in other respects, it's kind of like, you know, they're almost camouflaging themselves. I mean, you imagine most of the MIB kind of turn up late at night. They wear these fedora hats, trench coats with turned-up collars, wraparound sunglasses. You know, and it's almost like they're trying to convince us, you know, that they're human. But in some respects, you know, that they kind of look like us. But there are enough subtle differences where if you just saw them in the, you know, the open day, like without the sunglasses, without the hats, you'd think, wow, that person looks a bit weird. And, you know, so this has sort of led to the idea that could they be very human-like aliens, I suppose, kind of infiltrating us in some respect and, you know, but using some sort of camouflage to, I guess, you know, alter their appearance to maneuver and move amongst us, which, you know, does sound ominous, and, you know, perhaps we should consider it as ominous.
Well, you know, you've written a lot of books, including, well, the NASA conspiracies is a newer one. We have Contactees. We have Science Fiction Secrets, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, Strange Secrets. And one thing that you have established in your research is that sometimes these people who are just regular old civilians that you might think of as just, you know, wackos out there doing something on the fringe, they actually are being investigated by the government. I mean, your book about celebrity secrets prove that. I mean, you have people like Abbott and Costello, for God's sake, who were being, you know, monitored on almost a daily basis by the government. Do you think that some of these agents know people are paranoid about the Men in Black and that they try to play that role in order to make these folks more paranoid?
Oh, yeah, I actually do think that is a definite part of the subject, and this is one of the reasons why it's made so sort of convoluted and difficult to sort of nail it down to one thing or another, because it actually isn't. What I think's going on is that we have genuinely weird paranormal men in black who look strange, who act strange, who dress strange. Now, you know, whether they're alien, time travelers, paranormal, supernatural is debatable, but that they exist, in my mind, there's no doubt. But what I also think is going on is that there are people within government who are the people who are really charged with, you know, hiding the deeper and darker UFO secrets from the general public. And that to ensure that people won't talk about these things, or even if they do, they're going to look stupid, is that I actually do think there are certain people within government or agencies that exploit the weirder Men in Black mystery. So in other words, you have, for want of a better term, government agents who actually do dress in the fedoras, the black sunglasses, and who act weird. And it's almost like they're play acting, because if you think about it, it's kind of like a very good sort of psychological warfare technique, where if you want to silence someone and you turn up on the doorstep and flash an FBI card and, you know, I'm Agent John Smith from the local FBI office and you will not talk about flying saucers, the person could get quite irate and angry and contact their local congressman and say, you know, well, this is the man's name, he flashed an ID card. And sure enough, you know, then investigations are launched and he's tracked down and he gets a telling off for intimidating a member of the U.S. public. But if you want to silence someone and you want to make them look ridiculous, why not dress like the MIB? And then if the witness says, well, I got silenced by the government, you say, okay, well, who visited you? Well, these three guys dressed in trench coats and fedoras. Everybody's going to say, well, you've overdosed on too many Hollywood movies. You know, you're just fantasizing. And if you think about it along those lines, that actually works as very good cover for people in the government to sort of exploit the weirder Men in Black mystery, knowing that it's going to work as well for them. And maybe the government people really aren't that sure of who the weirder MIB are, but they realize that they're strange enough that if they exploit the mystery too, their tracks are going to get covered also.
Now, Tim Beckley has been on this show many times, and he has told us the whole story about the photograph that appears on page 65 of your book, and so there's no sense in recounting that whole thing, but
sure.
He believes that this is the only picture that has ever been taken of a man in black that he took in New York in 1968. Is this the only picture you found, or are there other images of a man in black?
Well, you actually included another one in the book, interestingly enough, also from the 1960s, and actually from 1 year later, taken by a researcher named Alan Greenfield. And Alan's done a lot of deep research into the entire Men in Black mystery, like Tim Beckley and John Keel going back to the mid-1960s. And Alan's someone who, you know, sort of deeply conversant and knowledgeable on the whole MIB phenomenon. And he was at a conference in 1969 where he saw one of these men in black, you know, who was described as having, again, the hat, the black sunglasses, the kind of zombie-like expression on his face, very cold, unemotional, almost unsettling was how he kind of described the sort of sensation and the feeling that emanated or oozed, if you like, might be a better term, from this MIB. And Alan's first thought was, well, you know, maybe this is just some sort of Walter Mitty-type character who enjoys playing Men in Black secret agent games, you know, likes to think of himself as some James Bond, and he goes along to a UFO conference to spook people out, you know, and make himself seem important, which isn't impossible or implausible. But what made this story very weird is that Alan confronted this man in black on the street. And the weird thing was that the guy let him take his photograph. And I reproduced the photograph in the book with thanks to Alan for letting me do that. And again, he has this sort of weird look on his face, kind of cold and enigmatic. He's got the sunglasses, the hat, the suit. And Alan said that the man, just after the photograph was taken, he sort of raced off around a corner, literally on the edge of the street. Alan said he was no more than maybe 4 or 5 footsteps behind him, raced around the corner after him, and as he got to the other side of the corner, the guy had literally vanished. And Alan said, you know, this is so weird because 42 years later, you know, 1969 to 2011, he said, it's so still visually clear in my mind because I'd never before or since experienced anything like that, where I was 3 or 4 steps behind someone racing around the corner of a street, and then as I get to the other side of the corner, they're just literally gone. You know, no lampposts, no cars to be
right
hide behind, just gone.
All right.
And Alan said if it wasn't for that aspect, you know, he'd have written it off as something else, but he said even to this day, it just sort of sends chills through him, if you like.
We'll take another break. When we come back, we'll talk about the idea these could be time travelers. I also want to talk about the connection between them and Ouija boards. And if you want to see at least one of these pictures that we're talking about, go to speakingofstrange.com, join the live chat, and Mobius is in there, and he's going to provide a link so you can see a picture of a man in black. I'm talking to Nick Redfern. His new book is The Real Men in Black. This is Speaking of Strange.
I've been alive for 4.5 centuries. I am immortal.
Here we are, born to be kings. We're the
This is George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, and you are listening to Speaking of Strange with none other than Joshua P. Warren.
Now, if you get a copy of Nick Redfern's The Real Men in Black and flip to page 209, you'll find that chapter 19 is called Time Travelers. And the bulk of this chapter is devoted to a conversation that Nick and I had. And it's about the idea that maybe these beings wear black because, and this is an idea that I maybe, you know, Nick can confirm, I think I kind of came up with this, because that for a number of complicated reasons, which I admire him immensely for capturing beautifully in this book, because it is not an easy train of events and possibilities to keep up with, maybe if you look at the idea that a guy wearing a black suit and a black fedora could be walking down the street in, you know, 1920, and you might notice him, but you wouldn't think anything, you know, especially extraordinary about it. You could go out tonight and see a guy walking down the street wearing a black suit and a black fedora. You might notice him, but you're not going to think anything is particularly out of the ordinary. That is an outfit that is able to fit into the culture of a wide period of time, around a whole century. And if some of these guys are time travelers that are literally trying to protect the timeline, because at some point in the future, time travel has been invented and there are beings trying to warp the timelines, somebody eventually has to manage this and police it. And maybe there is, you know, an outfit for the 1800s and an outfit for the 1700s and for the 1600s. And so when these guys go to work, instead of having to change clothes four or five times a day, they find outfits that will help them fit in within the largest chunk of time. And that the black hat and the black suit is so nondescript that it makes it easy for them to do so. Now, that said, Nick, what are your thoughts on that concept and time travelers in general related to this men in black phenomenon?
Well, you know, just I think it's a great theory, which is why, you know, I chose to include it in the book. And not just because, you know, you point out that, you know, the mode of dress, you know, is something that could sort of be suitable for spanning the decades, but because everything about the men in black smacks of being out of time. You know, they wear fedora hats, for example. Now, of course, you know, if you go back into history, you know, from the 30s, pretty much probably to the early 70s, you know, you would see a lot of people wearing fedoras, certainly 40s, 50s, 60s, and through to the early 70s. And even if you saw one today, most people probably would look twice if they saw a guy in a fedora and a black suit and skinny black tie walking down the street. But they probably wouldn't give it too much notice. They just think, oh, you know, he likes to dress like that, that's all. But the whole point is that the motif, the uniform, for want of a better term, is out of time. Now, on top of that, you know, the MIB are often described as driving old-fashioned cars, you know, sort of 1940s and 50s Lincolns and Chevys, you know, with the sort of the shark fin tails and the white wheels and the black cars, you know, again, looking like something straight out of a old-time gangster movie. So, in other words, everything about the men in black smacks of being out of time. You know, it's almost as if, you know, hypothetically, in the future, if the scenario is valid, the idea that maybe, you know, 30th, 40th century, there's only sort of the bare bones of an understanding of the history and culture of the 20th and 21st century, you know, to the point where they don't necessarily realize that, you know, coming back in 1960 and then coming back in 1980, that there's a tremendous difference in culture and fashions. And, you know, that could explain why the MIB looks so weird, because occasionally they screw up on the timelines. You know, the idea that they might not be our worst nightmare, but could actually be kind of time cops, you know, policing the timelines to ensure that, you know, damage isn't done to create time paradoxes, you know, the whole grandfather paradox, as it's known, going back in time and killing somebody's grandparents and then, you know, writing off our whole existence in the future. Maybe the MIB, you know, part of their reasoning isn't to silence people as such, but to sort of ensure that these paradoxes and new timelines don't occur. And I think, you know, I think you came up with a fascinating scenario that actually does make a lot of sense.
And, of course, for those who have not heard of this particular hypothesis, the paratemporal loop hypothesis, we definitely won't get into it on the show tonight, but it is rather extensive. And, again, you did just a masterful job of capturing it, because I wrote about it in The Secret Wisdom of Kukulcan, and you reproduced it, you know, artfully. So I thank you for that. And furthermore, before we have to go to our next break, what's up with this connection between Men in Black and Ouija boards?
Well, this is, you know, again, this is one of the areas why it's quite clear to me that there's an aspect of the phenomenon that has nothing to do with, you know, agents of the FBI or the National Security Agency or whatever. There are a number of reports which clearly link the Men in Black with sort of paranormal phenomena. Now, when I say that, there are a number of people, either researchers of the MIB phenomenon or witnesses to MIB, who have not just had an interest in UFOs, but they've been dabbling in the occult, the paranormal, the supernatural, and they've been trying to contact entities or open doorways and portals via Ouija boards. And then shortly afterwards, the Men in Black have been sort of either confronting them or plaguing them and, you know, sort of hanging around outside the streets and under street lamps late at night in the shadows and following them around and, you know, almost sort of tormenting them is probably the best way to term it. And, you know, when you find, as I relate in the book, I mean, I could have gone on and on, but for page purposes and space purposes, you know, I included about four or five cases in the book of people who were regular users of Ouija boards and then had the MIB turn up and, you know, essentially plague and menace their lives. And when you get that, to me at least, this suggests that at least an aspect of the phenomenon may not even have anything to do with, directly with UFOs, but perhaps, again, you know, they're more paranormal-based entities and, you know, that they're not literally from this government or that government, or maybe not even from nuts and bolts UFOs. You know, it's almost like they are kind of like a modern archetype of some sort of demonic entity, if you like.
All right, we're going to take our last break of this hour. When we come back, I will ask Nick his overall conclusion about what they are and what surprised him most. Ultimately, how can we condense all of these stories into a simple explanation? Again, his book is called The Real Men in Black: Evidence, Famous Cases, and True Stories of These Mysterious Men and Their Connection to UFO Phenomena. Be sure to visit The Real Men in Black .blogspot.com, which is currently linked up at speakingofstrange.com, to learn more about this book, share your experiences, see what other people have written. And of course, next hour we have the Dark 30 Hour, when we explore the most outrageous and controversial news as of late. And let me tell you, there is some pretty nasty stuff going on in the world. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
Or listen to the words that Jesus said about the road to happiness through love and charity. Why, you'd think he's talking straight to you and me. Well, we're doing mighty fine, I do suppose, in our streak of lightning cars and fancy clothes. But just so sick and lonely old, for the reckless ones whose bad trip left them cold. I wear the black and mourning for the lives that could have been. Each week we lose 100 fine young men.
It's Speaking of Strange, talking about the Men in Black. Not Johnny Cash, but close enough. And Nick Redfern's new book, The Real Men in Black, digs into all of it. Thanks for spending your Saturday night with us. So, Nick, here we go, my friend. Ultimate conclusions. What surprised you most, and what do you tell somebody who has never heard of the Men in Black who says, what are the Men in Black?
Well, I guess to answer the first part of the question, I think what surprised me most of all was that, you know, many people, even within ufology, kind of take the view that the Men in Black mystery is very much like a historical one, you know, for the 40s, 50s, and 60s with people, you know, like John Keel, Brad Steiger, Gray Barker, you know, writing books and talking about the phenomenon. I think the thing that surprised me most of all, but I guess pleased me as well in many respects, was the fact that the more I dug into it, the more that I found cases identical to those from the 40s and 50s of these very weird men in black still being reported today, even down to, you know, the fedoras, the skinny ties, the 1950s-style cars, but in the 1990s, in the 2000s, even as late as 2009, that's the latest case I include in the book. So, for me at least, that was the most surprising thing, that I guess, you know, the modus operandi of the men in black hasn't changed. I think it's more cultural assumptions that it's just one of those weird mysteries from a long time ago, and let's focus on Area 51 or Roswell or whatever, you know, not realizing there's this still undercurrent, under the radar, substantial number of reports, very similar, if not identical, to years ago. Now, when you ask, you know, well, who are the men in black? You know, as I said earlier, I think we need to ask, which men in black are we talking about? I think there's absolutely no doubt that, you know, some men in black, it's far more innocent in the sense that, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, there were government people who dressed like the FBI back then, you know, in black suits, black ties and fedoras. And I'm sure they were responsible for some MIB legends, but they weren't the men in black. There are also government people who have exploited, I'm sure, the men in black mystery to cover their tracks, as I said earlier, and to make the whole subject seem ridiculous if people talk about the fact that they were visited in silence. You know, so the MIB, there may well be government MIB who really do go out and, you know, specifically wear fedoras and wraparound glasses as a means to make the witness look stupid if they talk. But those issues aside, we're still left with this far more mysterious category of MIB. Now, who they are, that's the bigger question. Whatever they are, or whoever they are, they're very real. They seem to have as much of a tie or a connection to the world of the paranormal, the occult, the supernatural, as they do to UFOs, which, of course, has inevitably led to the theory that, well, is the UFO phenomenon not extraterrestrial, but, you know, sort of extra-dimensional or paranormal? You know, does it masquerade as alien? You know, this sort of opens a lot of doorways. The best that I can kind of say is that there's no doubt that this other category of MIB does exist, and it weirdly seems to straddle the world of ufology as much as it does the world of, you know, as we pointed out earlier, Ouija boards, the paranormal, the supernatural. There have been reports of people having poltergeist activity in their homes after MIB experiences. So I think the door's open on who the MIB are, but they're not from the Pentagon, put it that way. That's probably a good way to sort of word it.
And would you say that most of them are the weirdies, or are most of them just, you know, individuals who could be human?
Oh, no, the vast majority of reports are very strange. Most reports, you know, they follow a typical path of, even if the witness hasn't told anybody other than sort of close friends and family, it's like the MIB know. You know, they turn up 11, 12 o'clock at night, knock on the door. It's almost like the person's rendered into an altered state where they just open the door and let these MIB in, you know, not giving any sort of further thought to their safety, etc. And they just spill the beans on what happened, and then the MIB get up and leave, and then it's afterwards that kind of common sense comes back and the person thinks, why on earth did I let them in? It's like, you know, they were rendered almost into an altered state of mind to ensure that the MIB got into the home and got the information they wanted. Now, that doesn't, again, sound like government people. It sounds like some sort of, you know, malevolent force getting their grips into the mind of the person and just, you know, I guess psychically assaulting them in some respects is probably a good way to term it. And most of the reports do fall into that category rather than, you know, Agent Jones coming around from the local FBI office because you're talking too much about UFOs.
Well, Nick Redfern, you are the best. Congratulations on this new book. And, hey, keep up the good work. Thanks so much for being on the program tonight. When we come back, the Dark 30 Hour. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's Speaking of Strange.